I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source with the one-off diplomat, strategist, and historian, Chaz Freeman. Call this Curious Citizen Meets the Most Knowledgeable Straight Talker Anywhere Near the U.S. Government. At a turn in the calendar, a transition in American politics, in a global crisis that can feel like a rolling nightmare even after the quick, almost bloodless revolt by Syrians against their own deadly dictatorship. Chaz Freeman, it's the third year in a row that we've asked you for sort of end-of-the-season checkup on the American empire and the changing rules of world order. Start where you will, perhaps with the Syrian surprise, where, oddly enough, but revealingly, the U.S. empire met itself coming and going. It turned out our CIA had been in league with the triumphant rebel al-Jolani. At the same time, our State Department had a bounty on the same Jolani's head for his roots in terrorism and his taste for beheading his enemies. Did the U.S. government work at cross purposes like that in your time? Does it always?
Is this a great country or what? I mean, we can contain contradictions, as Whitman said. We can do things with our left hands that our right hands don't know about. In this case, in the case of Syria, what we've done is really uncertain. We don't know. Mr. al-Jolani, or Shara is his real name, Ahmed Shara, he has claimed that he has had a change of heart, that he no longer likes to behead people, that his faction is tolerant of Syrian diversity, which is probably one of the most diverse countries in the world with many, many ethnic groups and religious persuasions represented. But we don't know that that's true. And in fact, the stories coming out of Syria belie that claim. So we are seeing Christians harassed. We are seeing the disappearance of some clergy, Christian clergy. We are seeing mistreatment of the Alawites, who are the roughly 10% of the Syrians in a sect that the Assad family belong to. I don't know what is going to come out of this. But all of this is, I think, in a larger context.
Please.
The Biden administration is bequeathing a series of catastrophic messes to its successor. In Ukraine, the Ukrainians have essentially fought almost to the last Ukrainian. They have one of the lowest birth rates, if not the lowest, in the world. Their demographic profile does not have the number of young men that we are urging them to conscript and send to the battlefield. They don't have time to train the new soldiers that they need. The Russians are advancing. And the only good news is that we appear to have avoided the use of nuclear weapons that Vladimir Putin has threatened on numerous occasions. For two reasons. One, the Russians are winning, and they have no need to use nuclear weapons. And second, the Oreshnik missile, which is a combination of an ICBM with an intermediate-range missile, is terribly devastating and provides an alternative to a nuclear weapon. But Mr. Trump has promised that he will end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. I don't think there is a Gordian knot to be cut there. And I think we are going to see this war go on. And I very much expect something similar to the Korean conflict, in which the fighting continued as the negotiations proceeded. There will not be in Ukraine, however, anything like the demilitarized zone that resulted from that in Korea, for the simple reason that the Russians want peace, and so do Europeans. They don't want a division of Europe between contending forces.
We'll see about settling that war. It's an important question here. Fascinating, you start with Walt Whitman and our contradictions. If there's a thread in this story in my head, it might be the contradictions of empire. Reckless power, might challenging right, war, law, concentrated power, vast helplessness in this world. How do we deal with this reality of an incredibly contradictory array of our power now?
Our founding fathers created a limited government that was, they hoped, would remain limited and therefore not terribly competent. and we have created an empire, and we have proven to be incompetent managers of it. And so we are seeing it collapse before our very eyes. And the collapse has been accelerated, to go back to the Syrian situation, by our identification with Israeli genocide in Gaza, with Israeli aggression in Lebanon, and now with Israel's maiming of Syria in such a way as to ensure that a Syrian state, whoever runs it, will have no capacity for self-defense. There have been many hundreds of Israeli air sorties, the largest air campaign in recent history, against Syria that is essentially prostrate. Recently, the Israelis have destroyed the Syrian Navy, they've destroyed Syrian tanks, they've destroyed Syrian military bases. They have left Syria with no air defense at all. And the incumbent authorities in Syria, which is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, has decided not to contest these Israeli actions, in part because the Israelis helped it reach power in Damascus, but in part because they are trying to make a play for Western sympathy by pretending to be liberal democratic jihadis, something that is a bit contradictory. So our identification with this has totally destroyed our reputation globally. We have vast military power still, but we have learned in a series of defeats in our wars, we haven't won a war really for decades. The last one was the one I was involved with, which was the war to liberate Kuwait, and we bungled the peace that came after it. We are seeing a situation in which we remain militarily very powerful, but not omnipotent, and our legitimacy has essentially disappeared.
Talk about your contradictions. You can't not notice that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has set the standard of military boldness responding to the terror attack of October 7th last year. But the World's Criminal Court finds that he's also crossed the line into plausible case of war crimes, as you say, genocide. And we still don't know how to talk about that. He's carrying all before him in a certain sense, but he's deep in moral and maybe legal trouble.
So are we. Basically, the United States played a key role in attempting to create a facsimile of the rule of law internationally. The United Nations Charter was largely an American invention, and international law had our strong support until it didn't. And it has not had our support at all in the context of the Israeli expansion and genocide and ethnic cleansing and torture and other activities in the past decade or so. In fact, we propose something we call the rules-based order, which essentially comes down to we make the rules, we issue the orders, and we decide who is required to comply or not, and we exempt ourselves from those rules that we issue. This is not international law. It is the antithesis. This is something that the great Chinese legalist philosopher Han Feizi would recognize as a rule by law, that is, a ruler who exempts himself from the law but issues rules that bind everyone else. It is not international law, and we have abandoned our efforts to follow the UN Charter. You never hear about it anymore. And this has spilled over into our domestic realm. Parts of the American Constitution, the Bill of Rights, have essentially been suspended. The Supreme Court has recreated a monarchy that is more powerful than any monarchy existing anywhere in the world. We began our history with the overthrow of monarchical power. I won't say we're ending it, but we are entering an era in which there are no restraints on presidential power, and an elected president can do pretty much whatever he or she wishes.
I've got to say, the irrelevance of the United Nations is almost incomprehensible to your basic citizen. Here we have a world in terrible danger, and almost nothing being talked about around it at the United Nations. How can this be?
Well, we have crippled the UN Security Council and other institutions of the United Nations, like the World Trade Organization, or WTO, and we've done this very deliberately to assert our primacy internationally. That is the primary objective of our foreign policy now. It is essentially the Wolfowitz Doctrine, that is, an effort to ensure that our global hegemony is not challenged by anyone. Well, the problem with that is that others are rising or resurgent, and we are weakening our own power by delegitimizing it. And again, we have a great deal of pride in our military, and indeed they are an admirable group of men and women. But the weapon systems that we have tried in Ukraine have all been successfully countered by the Russians. We have given them an opportunity to study our military capabilities and devise counters to them. And you can bet that the Chinese and others who are facing a possible war with us have learned all the appropriate lessons. So I say the Biden administration is bequeathing to its successor not only a strategic disaster in Ukraine, but one in the Middle East, in West Asia, a likely war between Israel and Iran, very likely, now made more likely by the removal of Syria as a transit point between Iran and Hezbollah. Basically, the Israelis have successfully deprived Iran of its frontline defense, which was its relationships with Hamas in Gaza and with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And they have decimated Syria, devastated it. So now, what is the Iranian response? They don't have a deterrent anymore to Israeli attack. So the chances that they will go nuclear are now greatly increased. Israel recognizes that and is planning an early attack on Iran with the United States to try to eliminate the Iranian nuclear program, such as it is, and, if possible, carry out regime change in Tehran. I think this is highly problematic, but the Biden administration has established a regular pattern of remonstrating with Israel and then acquiescing in whatever Israel does and indeed vigorously supporting it. So Mr. Netanyahu must calculate that he doesn't have to wait for Mr. Trump to attack Iran. Of course, Trump is totally committed to an attack on Iran. He was the one who tore up the nuclear deal, which constrained Iranian nuclear programs. Iran has not heretofore made a decision to build a bomb. That is something that the Israeli intelligence apparatus, Mossad, and the CIA agree on. But our politicians believe it has, and Netanyahu asserts that it has. And from the Israeli point of view, this is an existential threat.
Can you explain why we keep hearing about Donald Trump's desire to bankrupt Iran?
Well, our policy, his policy, and the Biden administration continued it rather than reinstating the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, as President Biden had promised to do. Our policy is maximum pressure on Iran. This is a technique that we have applied to several other places, North Korea being the most recent. And the only result of it has been to push the North Koreans into developing a nuclear capability that can strike the United States with probably 50 or more nuclear warheads now. So this approach creates further threats. It does not reduce threats. And we have abandoned diplomacy. Nobody talks to anybody. Here's a war in Ukraine, a proxy war with Russia. Our Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has not visited Moscow during his entire time in office. Sergei Lavrov, the very capable Russian foreign minister,
everybody says so, yeah,
has not been to Washington for 5 years. We're not talking to each other. We meet with the Chinese and we exchange combative talking points. We don't listen. We don't carry out a dialogue. We don't take their interests into account when we speak to them. It's all lecture and no listening.
Your humble citizen is simply amazed at this. It seems to me that the first threat of a problem with Ukraine, Joe Biden could so easily have rented a suite in Istanbul and said, Mr. Putin, it's time we talk. What's bugging you? Can we listen to each other here?
In fact, of course, there was an agreement between Ukraine and Russia brokered by Turkey and Naftali Bennett, the then Prime Minister of Israel. That agreement had Ukraine redeclaring neutrality, not joining NATO, restoring the rights of Russian speakers and other minorities in Ukraine to use their own language to educate their children and communicate with local government. And this agreement, which was not entirely finalized, but almost, was sabotaged by a visit from the then British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, acting for us. So we didn't want peace. We basically wanted to weaken and isolate Russia, as we said, injudiciously admitted. We have not done so. Russia is now the largest economy in Europe, having overtaken Germany in purchasing power terms. It has never been as strong militarily since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we have not isolated it. We have reoriented it, pushed it into the embrace of China, Iran, and refocused it on West Asia and Africa rather than Europe. So this is a total failure. And Mr. Trump clearly recognizes that. But if he has a real plan to end this situation, it's not clear what it is.
I want to probe that, because it seems to me, for humble citizens again, it feels like a last chance for peace. And Trump isn't the first obstacle. I want to test my own humble thought that there could be a chastened empire hiding inside even the Trump MAGA base, a taste for restraint, for the jaw-jaw alternative to war, and that Trump somehow is in touch with that. He likes to say he's a man to end wars, not start them. In the debate with Kamala Harris, he was asked, do you want Ukraine to win this war? Bold and difficult question. He said, I want this war to stop. I want to save lives that are being uselessly killed. And maybe the key line was his saying, that war in Ukraine is a war that's dying to be settled. Words never spoken by Joe Biden. What are the possibilities there?
Mr. Trump was reelected because he is in touch with American opinion. Polling data shows that the American people are not in favor of continuing the Ukraine policy, not in favor of what the Biden administration has done in the Middle East, and are deeply dissatisfied, not just about foreign policy. We've just seen the assassination of a health insurance executive by someone who's been acclaimed by large numbers of Americans for taking violent action against an elite that doesn't listen to the public. There's a major problem here, and it occurs in other democracies too at the moment, and that is that the ruling elite is not in touch with the masses. The majority of Americans, humble Americans as you portray yourself, are not in favor of many of the policies that we follow. There is great disgruntlement under heaven. That is why we are seeing the emergence of various populist movements, not just in the United States, but in Europe, in Germany, in France, in Italy, in India. And here I want to make a point about the Middle East, if I might. One of the things we haven't seemed to notice is that the few secular governments in the Middle East, Libya was not a good government, but it did not have a religious agenda. Afghanistan, under us, was a secular government. Syria was a secular government, a particularly vicious one, but still secular, not religiously. Israel used to be a secular government. In every place, fanatics, religious fanatics, have taken power. Libya is now torn in a contest between several of them. Afghanistan has reverted to the control of the Taliban. Yemen, which was secular, is now dominated by various religious factions. And Syria has been taken over by an extremist Sunni movement, the exact nature of which we don't yet know. So this is something fairly profound in terms of a change in the world order. And it represents a rebuttal, a refutation of all of the values of the European Enlightenment that we once represented and that we tried to export and which took root which are now being dismantled by a resurgence of religious culture. This happened first, of course, in the Islamic Revolution in Iran, but we're now seeing the same thing repeat itself in other Islamic and Hindu societies.
Charles Freeman, come back to your notion, encouraging mine, that in the popular American head, there is more and more hesitation about our imperial pretense. And posing the question, how might Americans very practically get control of their, not just the forever wars, but the everywhere empire, that conception of ourselves? And among other things, challenging the storyline that the United States is or must be on some sort of war footing with the new prosperous China.
I think the youngest generation in our country has abandoned that warmongering attitude. But I note that, again, going back to the disconnect between elites and the populace, look at what the protesters of genocide in Gaza faced on university campuses and elsewhere. There is in this country now a strong force to suppress any dissent from the warfare state that we have created or from the policies that we follow. I don't know, I cannot recall at any point in the last, let's say, 75, 80 years, any kind of disinformation or information warfare campaign comparable to the one that we have faced. This is the deep state, if you will, fighting back against precisely the changes in public opinion that you mentioned. In the long run, I have to believe that popular opinion, which is in favor of restraint in foreign policy, a less militarized foreign policy, and which favors the rule of law internationally rather than dictatorial edicts by the United States and the G7, the club of former imperialist powers who purport to issue rules, I think we will see a change. But it's going to be difficult, and there will be combat at every point. It's not clear to me, really, how much Mr. Trump really understands about this. He understands enough to have fostered an insurgency against Washington in several ways, not just January 6th, but I think the public in general supporting him is saying, down with the establishment, down with the so-called blob, the group of foreign policy so-called experts who have an answer for everything in terms of the use of force rather than diplomacy. So I think the public is right to be disgruntled and dissatisfied with our leadership. And I note that in the last election, Kamala Harris ended up campaigning on basically more of the same. She did not separate herself from the Biden administration.
That astonished me.
It's difficult.
Has she not read the results of our wars in the last, virtually since World War II?
Well, I think of poor Hubert Humphrey, unable to separate himself from a powerful, vindictive Lyndon Johnson.
Yep.
And I'm sure that Kamala Harris was in the same dilemma. But the fact is that there was huge dissatisfaction with the status quo. So to mount a campaign on more of the same was to guarantee defeat. Mr. Trump, although very vague, promised change. And people feel sufficiently desperate that they're willing to try change, even if they don't know what it will be.
Can you imagine it reappearing on his agenda?
It may well, but then we have the signal. First of all, he's not in office, but he's somehow, quote, nominating, unquote, all sorts of people. And a friend of mine said that we've traded the clown car for a clown bus. with a whole series of clowns. If you look at them, I don't see many who are peacemakers. Although Mr. Trump promises something different, we may well see more of the same.
Hasn't time run out on the adventurous neocons, the omni-interventionists? I mean, the neocons are still in the Trump game, in Marco Rubio, for example, his choice for Secretary of State, or Mike Waltz, who will be his national security director. But my sense is that the politician in Trump, the feeler in Trump, is still hearing something else. How would we discover that?
Well, we will find out whether he is the prisoner of his entourage or his own man. My own guess is that he is his own man, but he is notably erratic and unpredictable. In fact, he takes pride in that. And he has a number of very useful ideas. One of them is that there must be a readjustment in our relations with Europe. It is now almost 80 years after the end of World War II. It is 80 years after the end of World War II in Europe, and yet the United States still garrisons it and takes responsibility for its defense.
And dominates NATO very openly.
Yes, we treat NATO as our sphere of influence in Europe, which is precisely why the Russians objected to it appearing in Ukraine. Everywhere that NATO expands, American troops and weapons follow. So basically, we were asking the Russians to accept the equivalent of a Chinese military presence in Mexico or Canada, which obviously we would not accept. I think Mr. Trump is right that the relationship with Europe needs a fundamental readjustment. Europeans must take more responsibility for European defense. They cannot continue to have a free ride and to avoid decisions by depending on the United States. And he has broken a cycle which is important, and that is we have had a habit of saying to the Europeans, you must do more in defense, but then adding, but if you don't, we'll do it for you, which deprives them of any incentive to get their act together. In effect, there is a danger that the United States, by adopting a more America-first posture, is not increasing its influence in the world, not leading, not making America great again, but diminishing American influence and isolating us from the fastest growing economies and fastest, most effective incubators of technology in the world. And here, the policy toward China is a case in point. China now has something over one-fourth of the world's STEM workers, scientists, technologists, engineers, and mathematicians. It is innovating in a remarkable way, not just in the military arena, although that is notable, but in terms of many, many other aspects. So we are not effectively responding to a world in which Anglo-American or transatlantic hegemony is being displaced by the rise of other economies and peoples and the resurgence of those who had been battered down, like the Russians. So we've lost political influence. Militarily, we remain strong, but the balance of power militarily has shifted toward China.
Their own modernization.
Their own military modernization has in many ways outpaced ours. They have railguns on their ships. We tried to develop that technology and could not do so. Their air-to-air missiles outrange ours. Their air force is a match for ours now in the region, and maybe beyond that. They have developed radars that can penetrate our stealth technology, or so they claim. And they are modernizing their nuclear forces and expanding them in response to our expansion and modernization of our nuclear forces. I just heard that the outgoing American ambassador to Beijing, Nick Burns, who's a very, very fine and accomplished diplomat, in his farewell assessment of his own activities, claimed that U.S.-China relations had been stabilized. But ironically, as he said that, the Chinese were running the largest exercise against Taiwan and the American forces coming to its aid that they ever have done. All three regional commands in China on the coast participated in this. There were hundreds of vessels and aircraft in the air, and they were deployed not just to intimidate or invade Taiwan, but they were deployed beyond Taiwan to prevent anyone coming to Taiwan's aid. So how this can count as stabilization is quite beyond me. And I think Mr. Trump faces a real problem. He may be dealing with it creatively. He has invited Xi Jinping, the president and general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, to attend his inauguration. This is unprecedented.
Have we heard back yet?
I don't think we will. I think this is a symbolic gesture by Mr. Trump, and it has two positive elements. One, he's signaling to the Chinese that even if he's about to mug them with tariffs, he wants to keep the possibility of a deal open. That is positive. And second, he is in tune with his own philosophy, arguing that problems with China can only be solved at the top, that his entourage, his Secretary of State designate, Marco Rubio, can take care of other problems, but that he himself will engage with the Chinese. So this is a gesture, a symbolic gesture. I don't think, however, that he's correct, that the Chinese can wheel and deal at the Xi Jinping level. Xi Jinping is primus inter pares. He is the core of the Chinese leadership, but that leadership is collective. China has politics too.
It's my cue to reframe the conversation around your own rather amazing history with China. You made your bones as a diplomat, as a very young man, U.S. Foreign Service officer, still in your 20s, interpreting Richard Nixon and Mao Zedong to each other in those breakthrough talks in 1972, that week in Beijing that changed the whole world. But there was this puzzle that was not solved in 1972, the matter of what's to do with the other China, which claims sovereignty of the whole place. Nationalists who repaired to the island of Taiwan and have thrived incredibly ever since. But it's now Donald Trump's puzzle, his riddle to wrestle with, and I want to know how you'd advise him. I'm also trying to picture Donald Trump as a reversioning of Richard Nixon. It was not a popular move Richard Nixon made at the time. He was a gambler. It was a long shot in a certain way. And I wonder if Donald Trump could ever conceive of himself as being in something of a similar spot. Time for a very bold, improbable move.
Well, Mr. Trump is clearly capable of that, as he demonstrated in his handshake and embrace of Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, in the DMZ at Panmunjom, and his unsuccessful efforts to produce a rapprochement between Pyongyang and Washington. So he shares with Richard Nixon an indifference to protocol and a willingness to break precedent in the broad interest. But he's a very different individual. Richard Nixon was also a rather strange personality, but he was a successful politician for many years, and he grew into a statesman. He was intimately familiar with international affairs. He had traveled the world. He had debated our adversaries. He was a gifted advocate in the courtroom and a very different personality. He also had the benefit of a compelling strategic incentive to reach out to China, namely his realization that Soviet threats to attack and subdue China would remove a key piece from the geopolitical chessboard and had to be prevented. He was determined to place China once again under American protection, as we did in World War II, when we had very little expectation that Chiang Kai-shek's government would make any gains against the Japanese who had invaded China. But they could serve the purpose of tying down an enormous number of Japanese troops and diverting Japanese attention while we conducted our war in the Pacific. So we made China essentially a protected state. We declared that its continued survival was essential to our strategic interests. And Richard Nixon did the same with the People's Republic of China in 1972. But those compelling strategic arguments have been replaced by other arguments that few people find quite as compelling because they're not military. Climate change. China is in the lead internationally in dealing with climate change. Its technology is the most advanced in the renewable energy area, and it annually installs solar and wind power that is equal to the existing stockpile of all the rest of the world combined. It is way in the lead in that. And we could learn a great deal and we could benefit a great deal from harnessing that technology. But guess what we've done? We have embargoed silicon from Xinjiang on human rights grounds, which are pretty dubious. And we accuse the Chinese of genocide in Xinjiang when they re-educate people but don't kill them. And we say that there is no genocide in Gaza when people are being murdered en masse. So this has no credibility. But recently, the Biden administration just put massive tariffs on imports of solar panels from China. That may help us develop our own industry, but it will not be as advanced, nor will it be as economic as what the Chinese produce. We have gone out of our way to block Chinese companies from other markets, but in the process, we've overlooked the fact that they have developed those markets, and we are now a declining factor in their international trade. So the influence we once had from interdependence with China is attenuated. They don't want to have a trade war with us, but they know how to deal with one, and they have begun to do so. They have just embargoed under export controls exports of rare earths, which are essential for our defense industry and for us to make semiconductors here. And it will take us years to overcome these impediments. They are replicating with us what we have done to them, because we have been embargoing, blocking, export controlling, and cutting supply chains with them like mad, and they are now reciprocating, which they hadn't done before. So I think it's fair to say that we are now in full economic war with China, with only Mr. Trump's arrival on January 20th needed to escalate it.
I want you to come back to instructing Donald Trump, should he ask you, about how to deal with this very real, both emotional and strategic and economic question about Taiwan's standing. Is it an independent nation? Would it be war if it were to assert something more like that? Is it a solvable problem? I come back to this sort of fanciful notion that what really drives Donald Trump in life is the art of the deal. And he's looking there at almost the ultimate deal in the world to solve that problem, unsolved after all these years. What would you tell him? How would you test the force of his zeal for the deal?
Well, first of all, I would point out that we had not a solution, but a mutual agreement to shelve this issue.
Forever?
Forever. That was what Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter worked out. And in fact, that worked very well in the 1980s. The two sides of the Taiwan Strait, Taipei and Beijing, had not been talking to each other. They began to do so. And they actually, in 2005, worked out a very extensive framework for interdependence. Air travel between the two sides of the strait is very easy. There are millions of Taiwanese living now on the mainland, and the two economies are quite closely related. There was no reason to disturb this, but we did. And we did it precisely in response to the question that you asked. Is Taiwan an independent nation? China has a law that says if Taiwan asserts that, it must use force to reincorporate Taiwan into its part of China. And we're playing with that. That is why the recent exercise that I mentioned, the huge exercise, intended not only to prepare for an invasion of Taiwan, but to halt any American effort to reinforce Taiwan, just took place. So I'd say to Mr. Trump, this is not a winning deal. If we cannot return to our original understanding, which was, let the Chinese on two sides of the strait work this out among themselves, and we will not stand in the way or do anything to complicate that, then I think we're in for a war. And you have to make a decision about whether you're prepared to lose half or two-thirds of the U.S. Navy and Air Force, which is what the war games we run suggest would happen. China would lose a comparable level of military strength. But this would essentially end the United States as a world power, because we have commitments we've undertaken to protect other nations all over the world. We would no longer have the capacity. So I would say to Mr. Trump, you should concentrate on trying to fix the problems at home and get the United States once again out of the middle of the Chinese Civil War, which has never ended thanks to our intervention in the Taiwan Strait right after the outbreak of war in Korea, June 27, 1950. And, of course, back the Taiwanese as best you can in working out some accommodation that preserves their democratic system and their role in the global economy. But otherwise, you're faced with the likelihood, almost the certainty now, given that there are no clear paths to a peaceful resolution anymore, you're faced with the very likely possibility of a war that would be trans-Pacific.
It's almost unthinkable and a completely...
ridiculous. Well, let me just say that the notion that a war with China over Taiwan can be limited to Taiwan and adjacent areas of China is utter nonsense. Mm. If we attack China, which we will, we cannot defend Taiwan without bombing the mainland, they will do something to us comparable. It may be nuclear, or it may be cyber, or it may be something utterly unconventional, but their military doctrine says that they will not strike anyone first, but if anyone strikes them, they will strike back. And their military doctrine emphasizes the need to go after the rear areas and logistics of any enemy force. So we are playing with the possibility of a nuclear exchange that could, if it were sufficiently extreme, end our species, not just us. So we now have people in the U.S. military, the Strategic Command, one General Buchanan, talking about winning a nuclear war, aiming to win a nuclear war with China or Russia. Although we agreed with the Chinese and the Russians at the Security Council years ago that, in the words of Ronald Reagan, a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. And yet, we are preparing for one with generals who salute and say, can do, I can win a nuclear war. Who'll be left? The cockroaches, perhaps, after such an event.
You're adding incentives for Donald Trump to figure this thing out.
Yeah.
What can the next president of the United States, what must the next president of the United States do?
President Trump should do what President George W. Bush did, rather unexpectedly. He agreed with the Chinese that a war over Taiwan should never be fought, and that this was a problem that we had in common, and that we should manage it. He agreed to that with Wen Jiabao, then the Prime Minister of China, during a visit to Washington. We need to disentangle ourselves from this. I yield to no one in my admiration for Taiwan's robust democracy, for the quality of life there. It is certainly, in my view, the best society that has ever occupied Chinese territory.
Right.
But Taiwan is Chinese territory. And any notion that you could do a kind of proxy war like the one in Korea or in Vietnam just won't fly. Therefore, unless we're prepared to contest the territorial integrity of a nuclear superpower, we should find a way to extricate ourselves, as Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger and Jimmy Carter did.
Extricate ourselves and leave it to the principals in Taipei and Beijing to work on it.
That was the premise on which we normalized relations with China, that we would stay out of this and let the two sides of the strait work out their own accommodation. And one should never underestimate the ability of Chinese, whether in Taipei or in Beijing, to do that.
What should be done meantime, Chaz Freeman, to disincentivize American politicians, not the president, I'm thinking inevitably of Nancy Pelosi, from asserting an American voice here?
I think Mr. Trump could play an educational role. He could make it clear that his objective with Taiwan is not military. It is not part of a military strategy against China, but that he is committed to the preservation of Taiwan's democracy and its political order, and that he will be prepared to talk to the Chinese about how to do that and to support Taiwan in any negotiations it conducts across the strait. We have said we are in favor of a peaceful settlement, sort of, but we have never actually tried to promote one. And Mr. Trump, if he is indeed the peacemaker he claims to be, could do that. And I think the American people, as long as democracy was preserved in Taiwan and the industrial capacity of Taiwan were left intact and there was no war that killed Americans, would be prepared to accept a compromise. But we're not there. We're dealing with this not diplomatically, but militarily. We have no diplomatic dialogue at all with either side on the question of how to make peace in the Taiwan Strait. Everything is about military deterrence. Mm. And military deterrence has the unfortunate consequence of producing arms races and confrontations. And that is exactly what has happened. We are in an arms race with China, with the mainland. And in many respects, we're losing. A war, when it happens, if it happens, will be, as I said earlier, devastating for our military as well as for the Chinese.
It adds to the incentive to reflect that when you think about Richard Nixon, when ordinary people think about Richard Nixon now, what was he all about? The first thing that comes to mind is the opening to China. How might Donald Trump contrive to be remembered for what he did about China?
I think if he could preserve Taiwan's democracy and back Taiwan in working out an accommodation that I think people on the mainland very badly want, he'd probably get the Nobel Peace Prize. Richard Nixon was a very hard-headed, cynical man. When we went to Beijing in 1972, and I accompanied him, we had no idea how this would be received domestically. It was a gamble politically, but it was a masterstroke in terms of foreign policy and geopolitics. I think Mr. Trump, if he were to take the Taiwan issue off the table, to remove it as a source of irritation in our competition with China, would earn a place in history that was very large. Richard Nixon, I think, surprised everyone. He had a personality that was widely considered to be vile. He was not known for his scruples. He was, in the end, tripped up by a combination of no scruples and bad management, which produced the Watergate burglary and brought him down in an impeachment process.
Judge Freeman, my education begins again. I can't thank you enough for your time, but your generosity and your learning and your example. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Chaz Freeman is a career diplomat who had major posts east and west and wrote many books along the way, among them America's Misadventures in the Middle East. Also a cookbook of Italian and French dishes made with Chinese ingredients. You can find his steady stream of talks and articles about current foreign affairs on his website, Chaz Freeman. It's chasfreeman.net. And that's our last open source show for the year. We'll be back in 2025 with more arts, ideas, and politics. Please think of us in your end of the year giving and sign up for our newsletter at radioopensource.org. Thank you.